MechCast, Tuesday, July 2nd, 2019. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. How is your summer going? It is flying by for me. I can't believe we're already sitting here the second day in July, just a little ways off of the July 4th holiday for those of us in the U.S., and just a little past Canada Day for you Canadians up to the north of us. So hopefully you had a good one. And hopefully if you are either planning or at or have had your July 4th, hopefully that worked out well for you also. I just can't believe how fast stuff is flying by. We have a ton of Apple and Mac news to get into today. Some really great stuff. Some sad news too, and we'll probably kick off things with that. We're also going to get into some of your feedback and some questions. We're going to be talking about Macs. We're going to be talking about iPhones and upcoming iPhones. We're going to talk about processors, the return of maybe some long-lost Macs, which is pretty exciting. We're going to get into the reasons why I'm actually talking to you on a machine that I normally don't record on. So there's a whole story behind that and a little bit of news to go along with it. Also, we're going to follow up on our conversation about sort of the missing products in Apple's Mac lineup. And then we're going to get into a question about hard drives and hard drive, not so much maintenance, but just checking your hard drives and what you may or may not want to do about that. So it's going to be a great episode. We are just going to dive right in, starting off with the big story of the week. What do you think about Apple's Jony Ive announcing that he will be departing from Apple? I guess it really came out in a press release from Apple themselves. They say Ive will be leaving the company later in the year. They don't say specifically when, just later in the year. And he will be moving off to form his own company called Love From with longtime design collaborator Mark Newson, and they will be forming that company in 2020. So I think it's safe to say that Ive is probably going to stick around until the end of the year. But that new company that he's forming, yeah, guess who their major client or one of their major clients is going to be when they fire up? Apple. So he's not going too far away. He's just going independent. He's leaving the nest. He's leaving the campus. And some of the rumors we heard were that he's already kind of done that in a way. He's been working a lot out of his own home studio in San Francisco. As a matter of fact, a number of the reports said he's taken meetings with Apple employees there, that he was really only going to the campus a few times a week to have meetings and stuff like that. That doesn't mean he checked out and wasn't involved, though. There were a lot of stories that seemed to allege that he had let his duties slide, and I think there's no truth behind that at all. You're also getting some reports saying that Apple's designs have not been good, that they haven't put out a hit product in a while. I just point to the Apple Watch and say, what are you talking about? I'll point to the AirPods and say, are you kidding me? I'll point to the HomePod. It might not be a critical success, but man, that thing is a great-looking device, and Apple is selling a lot of them. The new Mac Pro, look at the design and engineering behind that. This is all being done under Jony and his design team. And I think that's the important part, too, to remember, is that it's not just Jony there. It's his design team. And I think one of the frustrations he was probably having was he was more and more forced into kind of a management role. He was managing a team of designers there. And I think there were a number of things, and he talked about a lot of them in many interviews, that just wore on him. And when you're a designer, you want to design things. You don't want to be necessarily managing people. So I think the idea that he wants to move off and form his own company and do a, you know, get focused back on design. I think that's not surprising after so many years working just for Apple. And the ability to work on other projects and stuff like that, I think, is really important. Anybody who is a creative knows that feeling. And this wasn't a real shock. I think this news, we didn't know when it was coming, but we did know it was coming at some point. So when I heard the news, I don't know about you, but I wasn't really taken back by it. I thought, yep, it's probably time. I think another cool thing is it does give some of the other people at Apple an opportunity to get out from under Johnny's shadow. I mean, let's face it, the guy is an amazing icon, has done incredible work, and imagine being a really great designer in your own right at Apple and just being under that. It could be hard, I would imagine, to get noticed. What Apple is saying is going to happen when Ive leaves is that design is going to fall to two individuals. Apple's VP of Industrial Design, Evans Hanke, will be kind of handling the hardware stuff. And then you'll have VP of Human Interface Design, Alan Dye, who will be handling most of the software and application design, those sorts of things. And both those individuals are going to be reporting directly to Apple's COO, Jeff Williams. And that news has caused a number of outlets and caused a number of reports to surface saying that another problem at Apple is that Apple has more and more become an operations company, and they aren't quite the design and new product powerhouse that they have been in the past. And I think that, again, it's obvious, right? Apple is a massive company. They have grown incredibly over the last few years. They're shipping hundreds of millions of products a year. So naturally, yes, they're going to become more operations focused. They have to be. It's the only way that they can succeed. They've got something like 70,000 employees. That's just the way it works when you're that large of a company. But if you, again, look at the product line, and I think I talked about this last week, right? I think Apple has their strongest product lineup that they've ever had, and I think the mix is really, really good, even all the way and through and including through their services. You know, it's not just the hardware. It's the software. It's the services. They're getting a focus back on the professionals. It'll be interesting to see what happens on the software side of that when the new Mac Pro comes out. I think they've reaffirmed their commitment to that. And I think it's a more exciting time than ever to be an Apple fan. And again, I can't point to any one thing that says the designs are suffering. What might get a little bit better is some of the function over form stuff. I think, you know, one thing that happened under Ive's watch and arguably maybe could be directly attributed to his focus on thinness is the MacBook Pro keyboard. I don't want to lay all the blame on his feet. I think there's some engineering issues and other things there, but certainly that was a challenge. And I don't know that it was even the wrong direction to go in. I mean, that notebook is an incredible feat of design. It's an amazing looking product, and I think no one can begrudge that. Yeah, it might have had some functional issues, but hey, you can't win them all, right? There are lots of things you could point to. The hockey puck mouse that came with the original iMac, that was really cool looking from a design standpoint. But as we know in hindsight, it really didn't work functionally. And it was quickly abandoned and Apple learned from it. And all of these things are lessons that you learn from and you move on and you grow. And in order to grow and continue to grow as a designer, I think I've just looked around and said, hey, I've done this part. I've done all this stuff at Apple. I've achieved this part of my goals in my career, and it's time for the next phase. And he's going to move off, and I think we are going to see somebody rise at Apple. The one thing in all of this, the one sort of analysis that I tend to agree with a little bit, though, is the concern, or the growing concern, that at Apple you don't have necessarily the iconic single visionaries that you did in Steve Jobs and Johnny Ive. I think what he brought to the table was a sort of, hey, the buck stops here. I'm going to make the design choice, even if it's a bad one, even if it's one that causes a problem, at least you have that person saying, nope, this is what we're going to do. This is the direction we're going to focus on. We're going to move in. And I think that's really important. His title was Chief Design Officer. He was the head of design. So all design rose up and landed on him. And now at the top of that, you do have an operations person in Jeff Williams. And I don't know that that's the right choice. I'm hoping this is only a temporary thing. I'm hoping Apple is waiting to see who kind of comes out and sort of rises out of that design group to maybe reassume that role of Chief Design Officer. I think it would be a good idea to have someone in that position. But for now, it's going to be a couple people, and we'll have to just see how it goes. You know, I'm not going to rush to judgment like a lot of the media is. We're getting, as we often do, a lot of this Apple is doomed stuff. And you know and I know we've been through this so many times before. It's never been correct. It's never been the reality. Apple is an amazing company with an amazing pool of very, very talented people, and I think they're going to continue to produce incredible, great products that have amazing designs that the rest of the world in the technology industry ends up copying. Let's just face it, that's usually what happens, and I don't see that changing even with Ive on his way out. And again, I think it's important to remember he's not out, right? He is going to be collaborating and continuing to work with Apple. This just changes his capacity. So a lot of you have been emailing me to write in and ask my thoughts on it. I've sort of looked at this and read a lot of the reports, and my analysis of it is just It's going to be fine. We're all going to be fine. Ive is going to ride off into the pale white room on the horizon, and he'll still be there when Apple needs him, and Apple will go on and continue to produce and create incredible products, and they will have high quality design. But that's just my take on it. I'd love to get your thoughts and opinions. If you want to shoot me an email, send me an audio comment, you can send those to maccast@gmail.com. One product that we should be seeing pretty soon that does have an amazing design and is made of titanium is Apple's new Apple Card. And while this might not be this week the first look that we got at it, we did get some more details, because what's happening is, and I think we talked about this on the last episode, Apple employees are starting to get Apple Cards. They can actually apply for them, get approved, and they are being sent to Apple employees. And iMore got their hands on some images of a card from an unnamed Apple employee. They protected their identity, which I think is a good thing. And they were able to kind of give some details on how the whole process is going. Cards, it looks like, are being approved for folks with credit scores as low as 600, although they are adjusting the credit limits down. So if you have a lower credit score, it looks like you will have a lower credit limit, as low as like $1,000. Annual percentage rates are ranging, as we expected, from between 13.24% to 24.24%, again, depending upon your credit rating. So, you know, that little thing that Apple talked about where they said they were going to have the lowest rates in the industry, yeah, they're pretty standard rates. They might be at smidge lower compared to a competitor, but if you're expecting like rock bottom interest rates, that's not really what you're getting. You are getting a credit card. Now, that credit card is super cool looking. Like I said, it's titanium, and it comes in a plain white sleeve with an embossed Apple logo on the outside. That's the only sort of marking, but then you flip it open, the little folio, and the sleeve inside is colored to match the color categories you get when you start making purchases within the app. So your purchases are kind of color-coded, and the more you buy in one category, entertainment versus food or something like that, the colors will shift to kind of show you a visual representation of how your spending is. And so the inside of the card is like that. It does have a little area that has an embedded NFC chip. So one really cool thing you can do is when you first apply and get approved, you do get the digital version of the Apple Card right away. It goes into your Apple Wallet on your iPhone. Once you get the physical card, you simply tap your iPhone to that NFC chip, and boom, your card is activated. So you don't have to call a phone number. You don't have to put in weird pins or anything like that. It's just automatically activated through your phone and ready to use. The front of the card has a engraved, embossed Apple logo, the chip, and just your name on the front. And then the back has a mag stripe, the embossed Goldman Sachs logo, because the cards are issued through Goldman Sachs, and MasterCard. So you get a MasterCard logo, Goldman Sachs logo, and that is it. There's no credit card number. There's no signature area. There's not even a security or CVV2 code on there. All of that is accessed through the app on your phone. And then finally, the other little detail we've got is that it weighs about a half an ounce, or about 14.75 grams, which is about the same weight as, I think, three plastic credit cards. So it is heavier. It is metal. And just very, very cool looking. And Apple is supposedly going to be rolling those out to the public sometime this summer. I am excited to apply and get my hands on my Apple card. I'm thinking it could happen any day now. I'm not thinking they're going to wait until August or the end of the summer. I think with Apple employees now kind of testing those out, and they already had Goldman Sachs employees kind of pre-beta testing the cards, I think we could see it happen sometime in July. I'm going to predict maybe mid-July when you'll be able to get your Apple card. Who's ready for the return of a lunch tray MacBook Pro? If you've been around long enough, you know what I'm talking about. In case you don't, the 17-inch MacBook Pro. So Apple used to have a 12-inch MacBook Pro. Hopefully I'm getting these sizes right. A 15-inch MacBook Pro, or 14-inch. It was either 14 or 15-inch MacBook Pro. And then they had a whopping 17-inch MacBook Pro. And that 17-inch MacBook Pro was a favorite among a number of people I knew, specifically designers. Also, programmers tended to like that model because it gave them a lot of screen real estate for their code. And then when Apple did their transition, their shift to the MacBooks, in the MacBook Pro lineup, we wound up with just the 13-inch and the 15-inch. And the 17-inch model went away, much to the chagrin of many people. Well, this week, we're hearing a report from IHS market analysts claiming that Apple is getting ready to release a 16-inch MacBook Pro in September. So not quite 17 inches, but reduced bezels and all that, it could be about the same screen size probably as the original 17-inch MacBook Pro. But point is, a larger MacBook Pro. They say the displays are going to be coming from LG, which is kind of where they're getting some of these rumors from, because they're checking the supply chain, and that they will have a resolution of 3072 pixels by 1920 pixels. And this does seem to back up a rumor from a previous source that said Apple was talking with Samsung, possibly about a 16-inch OLED display for MacBook Pros, though in this case, the display from LG would still be LCD. So maybe it just didn't work out to get OLED displays and they've fallen back to the LG, but it does seem to indicate that Apple is looking to do a larger MacBook Pro. Ming-Chi Kuo also commented a while back that he expected Apple to release a MacBook Pro with a, quote, all-new design sometime in 2019, although he never specifically mentioned anything about the details of the display. So I don't know if we'll still get redesigned MacBook Pros in addition to this, or if this will be a redesigned MacBook Pro. But nonetheless, a larger MacBook Pro, I think, would be a welcome addition to the lineup for many people. So if you like really big notebooks, Apple may have a product for you later this year. Another thing related to Macs that came up this week is related to the new Mac Pro, that amazing new screaming Pro machine that most of us probably can't afford and won't be getting, but it is the one that's replacing the current trash can Mac. And one thing that is going to change, apparently, when the new Mac Pro comes is that it will no longer be assembled in the USA. Unfortunately, it looks like, according to reports, this is coming from the Wall Street Journal, that Apple will no longer assemble those in Texas. The new cheese grater MacBook Pros are going to be manufactured and put together by Quanta Computer in China. Now, an Apple spokesperson tried to buffer the report, saying that the Mac Pro is designed and engineered in the United States, and it includes some U.S.-made components, which is true. iPhones also contain many U.S.-made components, and they are designed in the United States as well. But guess what? A lot of the manufacturing, production, and assembly, that happens in China. So it's, you know, just kind of sad. It's not a big deal, but it's sad to see the Mac Pro going back to China when it was kind of a big deal when it came and was starting to be assembled in the U.S. And I had some hopes that maybe Apple might start to do more manufacturing in the U.S., but it's looking like it's not going to pan out that way, even given the current climate with possible sanctions coming into play. So that's a little bit surprising too, but a lot of those manufacturers have assembly and places they can move outside of China that still aren't the US. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. But for now, it looks like the cheese grater Mac Pro, yep, that's going to be made in China. It was also noticed this week that Apple received FCC approval for another new MacBook Pro model, number A2159. What was interesting about this was a couple things. Specifically, that was a number that was recently registered with the Eurasian Economic Commission, and it's also not a model that is in Apple's current lineup, and it doesn't seem to line up with the 16-inch MacBook Pro rumor either, because in the FCC filing, there are some images that show it looks like that model is a 61-watt model, which would seem to indicate that it is a 13-inch MacBook Pro. But if you remember, we had an update to the MacBook Pros just back in May, so you would think it would seem unlikely that Apple would be refreshing the 13-inch MacBook Pro line so soon, until you remember that one of the models that they did not update was the non-touch bar version of the 13-inch MacBook Pro. So we could be getting a updated version of that model. I think that is likely to happen. Another thing that happened, interestingly, after this report started surfacing, the FCC pulled all the documentation and all the references to that new A2159 machine. So who knows if that came at the request of Apple or if maybe they just made a mistake. Don't really know. I think we'll see some MacBook Pro updates maybe in September. So maybe we'll get an updated 13-inch along with that new 16-inch model. One thing we've discussed many, many times here on the MacCast is that the future of the Mac lineup may be based in Apple's own processors. So we know that Apple has made processors for their iOS devices for a long time. The A-series processors are incredible feats of engineering. Apple really staffed up their design talent and put together a team that can make some incredible processors that perform incredibly well. We know on the Mac side, they've been relying on Intel for years and years and years, but there has been longstanding rumors that Apple has plans at some point to try and put out an ARM-based Mac, and it's still believed that will happen. Many believe that Apple could put a ARM-based processor out for a Mac as early as next year, 2020, and a recent hire spotted on LinkedIn seems to add some fuel to that fire. Apple has apparently hired ARM's former lead CPU and systems architect, Mike Filippo. He actually led the development for many of ARM's processors, including their upcoming 7-nanometer plus and 5-nanometer chips. He brings a ton of experience and has also worked in chip design and architecture for both Intel and AMD. So this guy is incredibly talented, been a lead at ARM, and now he is working for Apple. What could he possibly be working on? Now, Apple has a lot of various chip designs that they do, including those A-series processors, so it could just be more talent to add fuel to that fire. But I think it's very likely that ARM processors are going to show up in Mac. I think Apple wants to have an Apple-designed CPU in their machines at some point. And one of the future advantages of an ARM-based CPU might be that developers could eventually be able to build a single binary, a single application that could run across both iOS and macOS seamlessly and easily. And we already know with the current Catalyst project that they're working on the UI side of things. So if they can get that sorted out and those libraries put together, and then you have a way to just simply build a single app that will run across platforms and devices, that would be an incredible thing. And certainly having the same processor technology in your desktops and notebooks as you have in your tablets and your iPhones would make that a lot easier. Filippo could also take on some responsibilities for the A-Series development. Like I said, they did a hole was left on that team when Gerard Williams III, Apple's lead A-Series designer, left the company back at the end of March. So this could just be filling that hole, but I have a feeling it could be doing double duty, filling that hole and also bringing on some talent to lead the charge to put out a Mac with an Apple-designed processor, maybe as early as 2020, and that would be amazing. The question in my mind is where would Apple start? Would they start on the high end with something like the Mac Pro, where they don't have as many units as they maybe sell? I mean, Apple tends to stick with enterprise-grade processors like the Intel Xeons there, so the question would be, can an ARM processor pull off that kind of performance, or would they start with something smaller like the Mac Mini and maybe work up from there? Maybe even iMac. I don't know. Notebooks? I really have no clue which model might be the first ARM-based Mac. I have a feeling it could be a notebook like the MacBook, something that kind of bridges the gap between an iPad Pro and a notebook. Maybe it'll be Apple's first touchscreen Mac that they say they're never going to make. We'll just have to wait and see. But I think it's just one of those things that's inevitable that eventually we'll have a Mac with an Apple-designed processor in it. As the summer rolls on, we'll be getting more and more solidification of the designs of the upcoming iPhone, which should be out in the fall. The iPhone 11, we'll just call it for now for lack of a better name. It's likely going to be the 11. It'll be interesting to see what Apple does with the marketing campaign around that. But we continue to get rumors that it will have a triple lens camera system and that it is going to have that square, what I call the cracker bump, basically large square bump. What's interesting is it's expected that the iPhone XR is going to get a bump up to a dual lens camera system when that happens. And the designs we've even seen for that have a square camera bump with the flash sort of in a triangular orientation. So you've got the two lenses and then the flash off to one side. And I think a microphone hole, and it's all in that big square camera bump. So I guess that's just what you call kind of, you know, leaning into the skid or turning into the skid, however it is. Basically, they're owning that camera bump wholly and completely, and they're just doing it across the board. I have a feeling they're going to go with a square just to keep the designs consistent across the phone lineup. And the third lens that's in there is expected to be a super wide lens added to the existing wide lens and telephoto lens. And an interesting thing, too, is supposedly the back glass is going to incorporate that camera bump. So it's going to be one seamless piece of glass that just integrates that bump into it, meaning you're not going to have that sort of metal frame around it. So I guess it'll just kind of be under that glass. One thing to me is that just seems pricey, right? The glass on your iPhone is already expensive to replace. And in this case, you're basically going to have to replace that and maybe the camera lens assembly and everything. So I don't know. It's going to be cool looking, but wow. We'll have to wait and see. There's also reportedly going to be a redesigned mute switch that moves up and down, more reminiscent of the original iPad. So rather than going left to right or front to back, it's going to move up and down along the side. And the iPhone 11 is expected to retain the Lightning connector, but Apple could include in the box a Lightning to USB-C cable with an 18-watt USB-C wall adapter. So you'd have USB-C on the wall side, but still connect the phone through a Lightning connector. Although I have a feeling these days more and more people are going with wireless charging, and certainly the new phone is going to have wireless charging as an option as well. The overall design is expected to look largely the same as the current iPhone XS and XS Max models, still with the notch for the true depth camera system. So if you're not a notch fan, that is not probably going away. So overall, you know, it's going to be a spec bump. It's going to be new camera updates. It's going to be a lot of more of the same that we've been getting with the iPhone. And I think more and more, that's going to just become the norm. I'm not sure what other directions Apple could take the iPhone in. And we've talked about this in the past, too. I think until something comes along that completely replaces the smartphone, this is going to be the status quo. Spec bumps, new features, better cameras, faster processors, more GPU, more CPU. But beyond that, not a whole lot that can be done. Until we get to visors and goggles and virtual reality systems and voice interfaces and all that sort of stuff, yep, this is the way it's going to go. So I don't see a lot of people upgrading. It'll be interesting. I will probably upgrade for the camera system again. I tend to get a new iPhone every year, but I think I'm the exception, more the exception than the rule these days. And I need it so that I can talk about it here on the podcast and keep you up to date on how things work. But I think for most consumers, there's going to be very little reason to need to upgrade. It'll be more a want to upgrade than anything else. So that's what's happening with the next generation iPhone, at least as it stands right now. One thing related to iPhones and Macs and Apple Watches specifically is displays, and Apple gets a number of their displays, specifically LCD displays, from one company, Japan Display. And I think we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast that Japan Display has been struggling. They did not make the transition to OLED very early. Apple has kind of helped them out with that. They're ramping up their production facilities. I do think there were rumors. I don't remember if they're actually making OLED displays for Apple Watch, or they might. I think actually they might be able to make OLED displays for the next Apple Watch, but because Apple's iPhone sales are slowing, and actually just other smartphone companies' sales are slowing, there's less and less demand for LCDs, and that has hurt Japan Display. So they've been looking for a bailout for some help, and we got news this week that a Chinese sort of conglomerate of companies is going to be stepping in to help Japan Display out with an investment, and reportedly one of the companies in that group is Apple, although they're not being named directly. But it is being reported and rumored that Apple will be dropping about $100 million into that fund to help out Japan Display. It's also being rumored that Apple may waive part of the money that Japan Display owes Apple for guaranteeing LCD orders, so that could also help with some of the funding, and they're struggling. Ultimately, I think they're going to have to transition to OLED, and I believe some of this money would be used to kind of help beef up their efforts moving in that direction. One of the big changes that we know is coming in macOS Catalina is that Apple is going to take a note from iOS and break up the iTunes monopoly on the Mac. So we're going to be getting podcasts, we're going to be getting music, we're going to be getting audiobooks in the Books application, and iTunes functionality, syncing functionality, is going to be moving to the Finder. So everything's breaking up. There's been a lot of questions about how that's all going to work. I think it's more or less going to be seamless in terms of the upgrade, but at least one thing that is changing, if you believe the current beta, is support for multiple iTunes libraries. Currently, the beta does not have support for it, although it could show up before the final release in the fall. So I think it's a little bit too early to incite panic, but apparently you're going to have to pick one library when you first install the macOS Catalina. That will attach to your podcasts and your app, your music app. And that is sort of it. You can still apparently hold down the option key on launch and pick a different library. But what wasn't clear to me is if this was an only one-time-only operation in the current beta. Otherwise, it sounds to me like it pretty much functions like it does in iTunes now, unless there's some way inside iTunes that I'm not aware of where you can actually select and change your library. I guess you can always go into the system preferences and pick a different library in iTunes. So I guess maybe that's the functionality that's being removed. But you've always had the ability to hold down the option key on launch and pick different libraries. So I guess it's just going to be a little different, not so much that it is necessarily going away. You just don't have that easy way to switch between libraries. But a lot of people were kind of freaking out in the media this week about that. I think it's going to be more or less a non-issue, and I could see Apple actually just bringing that functionality back into the final release in the fall. Remember, right now, everything you're hearing and seeing, it's coming out of betas. It's not the final release software, and as everything goes with Apple, nothing is done until it's done. So you really have to wait for the shipping release before you make your final judgments. So just be aware of that, but wanted to bring that up this week because a lot of people were kind of freaking out about that. Eddie Q says that Apple Music now has 60 million paid subscribers. That's 10 million more since the last time they announced a number, which was back in January. So growth continuing, but maybe not at the skyrocketing pace it has been in the past, but still 10 million new subscribers, new paid subscribers in about 6 months. That's nothing to scoff at. He also said that Apple has entered most of their own lyrics for the new live lyrics feature, the karaoke feature in iOS 13. That was kind of a jab at Spotify, who Google alleges has stolen a lot of lyrics from. And he also spoke again about that breakup of iTunes, saying that overall it's better and less confusing to have users have separate apps for music podcasts. Although he did note he has his own iTunes holds its own place in his heart too, because like a lot of us, he has come up through the ranks of Macs and music with iTunes. And so it's a little bittersweet, right? I think that's what a lot of people are reacting to when it comes to the breakup of iTunes. I think we all recognize that having separate apps is probably better and the best thing in the long run, because iTunes just became too conflated and sort of multi-headed and confusing, and that caused a lot of the problems. Some people still think that Apple could have gone in and fixed it all. I think this tactic that they're taking is much better, and it brings parity to the experience. Again, more unification of your listening experiences across your devices and your desktops and laptops. And I think ultimately that is going to be a good thing, and everybody is going to adapt. And like I said, it doesn't really seem to change too much, right? If you're syncing, you're just going to have those settings inside the Finder, which to me makes a lot more sense. You dock your iPhone, your iPad, and it shows up in the Finder sidebar. You click on it, and you get all of the same options that you had previously inside iTunes. It makes sense to not have to launch a secondary app to access that functionality. So I think it's going to be ultimately good. But if you have a different opinion, let me know about it. Maccast@gmail.com. And then finally, in the news for this week, Apple Pay has rolled out to more of the world, and actually a lot more of the world, depending upon your point of view. Apple Pay is now available to users in Slovakia, Portugal, Greece, and Romania. Apple actually tried rolling out in Slovakia many times, but always was delayed. So they kind of went down that path, got delayed. It is now out officially. The new rollouts do come with support from a number of European banks, including Monese and N26. There are additional countries that are also getting support through the online bank Revolut, which is, I believe, a UK bank. So that's kind of the caveat, right? Bulgaria, Croatia, Cyprus, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Malta, and Slovenia all getting support, Apple Pay support through Revolut. So I don't know if there's more local banks in those regions that are also supporting Apple Pay, but nonetheless, a lot more countries being added to Apple Pay, and Apple seems to be continuing a pretty aggressive rollout strategy for Apple Pay. As you know, I am a big fan of Apple Pay. I'm using it more and more and in more places, which is great, and more places are taking it. I still do get the occasional, though, yep, we don't take Apple Pay, but we take Samsung Pay, which is incredibly frustrating as an Apple fan, as you might imagine. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Linode. Look, if you need hosting, an amazing thing about Linode is freedom. You get a lot of freedom with Linode, and I think that's apropos considering we're very close to 4th of July here. Basically, Linode allows you to instantly deploy and manage an SSD server in their Linode cloud. You can get a server up and running literally in seconds, and you get your choice of Linux distributions, resources, and 10 different locations. So you can pick the location, you can pick the flavor of Linux you want to run, you can pick all of the resources and basically configure the best server for you. And best of all, they're giving new Maccast customers a $20 credit. So whether you're wanting to set up a gaming server, something for Minecraft or Terraria or Arc, maybe you want to set up a WordPress server, you want to start a blog, Drupal, GitLab, OpenVPN, you want to make your own VPN server, you can do it on Linode. They offer a whole bunch of pre-configured distributions that you can pick and choose from. If it runs on Linux, basically it runs on Linode. But don't worry, if they don't have what you want, you can actually upload and create your own custom images. So, like I said, freedom. You can basically build whatever server you want for whatever you need it to do. And they feature amazing technology, SSD storage, a 40 gigabit network, and industry-leading processors. And finally, you can pick between any of their 10 worldwide data centers. They have a new location just opened in Toronto, Canada. That one is using their most up-to-date hardware and their next-generation network backbone. It allows you to comply with in-country data protection requirements while taking advantage of all of Linode's technologies and tools. And they're going to be opening a new data center in Mumbai, India, by the end of 2019. Best of all, pricing is simple as well. No surprise fees. You pay for what you use with hourly billing across all of their plans, and you have a lot of flexibility there as well. You can start with a $5 a month Nanode plan and go all the way up to a high-powered dedicated CPU plan. And then you can add on things like backup, large storage volumes, and even load balancing. And their dashboard makes it easy to see all that stuff, to manage it, and move between tiers and plans and all that sort of stuff. It really is a nice interface. I like it a lot. I set up a Minecraft gaming server with them, and it was seamless and easy. And best of all, if you do run into trouble, 24/7 live customer support. They have a large documentation library that provides a great resource if you get stuck. So if you want to get set up with your new server today, do it on Linode. Visit linode.com/maccast to set up your first Linode, and you'll get a $20 credit when you use the promo code maccast2019. That's linode.com, linode.com/maccast, and make sure to use the code maccast2019. And a huge thanks to Linode for their support of the Maccast. So you might have heard this past week that Apple had a recall on some 15-inch MacBook Pros, the mid-2015 models. And guess what? Yours truly? Yeah, I went to Apple's support website. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But they have a page on their support website for the MacBook battery recall program. Go in there, you put in your serial number. Yours truly put his in, and sure enough, my MacBook Pro has been recalled. So I'm actually recording this episode of the MacCast on an old 2011 MacBook Air. Hey, not too bad, an 8-year-old computer. Because Apple took my lovely MacBook Pro and they're going to hold on to it for what they tell me is about a week or two. That was the quoted time frame. And unlike has happened to me in the past, I haven't gotten it back quicker yet. I've been without the MacBook. When did I drop it off? I dropped it off on Thursday last week. So we're almost a week. I'm expecting to be another week without my MacBook Pro. What's going on is that Apple has determined that a limited number of older generation 15-inch MacBook Pro units, they have bad batteries that may overheat and pose a fire safety risk, so they're implementing this voluntary recall. And, you know, for me, I'm thinking, hey, I got a 2015 MacBook Pro, although I didn't get mine until 2017, but I haven't been very good on the battery, so I leave it plugged in way, way too much, and so I get a new battery out of it, and it's amazing that Apple supports such an old model. You know, I think a lot of companies would just say, nope, buy a new machine. The affected units were sold primarily between September 2015 and February 2017. And like I said, the product eligibility is determined by serial number. So if you have a 2015, a mid-2015 15-inch MacBook Pro, you'll want to go to the website, check yours, and see if it's not impacted by this recall. And it's pretty easy to do. If you do have an affected model, what you want to do is take it to an Apple authorized service provider, take it into an Apple retail store, into the Genius Bar, or contact Apple support, and you can arrange a mail-in service via the Apple Repair Center. And I think all of them, at least here in the United States, still get sent out to Texas. And they get worked on. I was told in this case, you know, normally they would just replace the whole bottom case, but I was being told in this case they are actually opening them up and just simply replacing the batteries. So I'll report back on that, whether that turns out to be the case or not. The other thing to know is if you do need to take your machine in, you're obviously going to want to make sure you have a full backup, and because there is no guarantee that it's going to come back with your data on it. They shouldn't have to do anything related to that, but I've heard too many stories from people who have sent their machines in. Apple tells them, yeah, we're not going to have to touch your operating system or anything with the hard drive. And lo and behold, they throw it on the bench, they find some problem with the hard drive, and then they swap out the hard drive. Good news is you get a new hard drive. Bad news is your machine comes back totally wiped without your data. So always make sure before you take a machine in for service, an iPhone, an iPad, actually any product, that you do have a full backup. And the only other thing that kind of came up this week is that Apple is also replacing the logic boards in a limited number of 2018 MacBook Airs. Similar to the 2015 program, they have a page on their website where you can plug in your serial number if you have a 2018 MacBook Air and see if your model is impacted by the logic board recall. Same kind of thing. You'll take it into Apple and they will swap out the logic board for you. So just a couple recall programs to talk to you about. And I did get hit by this one this time. And it just seems to be another in a long line of my issues with my MacBooks. My 2015 MacBook Pro, some of you might have heard this story, but maybe others haven't. It is actually the third MacBook that Apple has given me since I made a purchase of a MacBook Pro in 2010. So my 2010 model went through four logic board replacements before Apple decided, hey, no, you've suffered too much. We're going to give you a new MacBook Pro. So they upgraded me to a new 2011 MacBook Pro. And then my 2011 MacBook Pro proceeded to have four logic board replacements as well. And almost every single time it was the video issue with the solder joints on the dedicated graphics processor. So went through four of those. They were going to replace another logic board for the fifth time. I complained a little bit heavier and they agreed to let me buy, mind you, 2 weeks before the Touch Bar MacBook Pros were going to be announced, they said I could buy anything in the store for half off. So I bought my maxed out 2015-inch MacBook Pro at that time. And now that's been recalled as well. So I've had a bit of a run of bad luck with my MacBook Pros, but I'll tell you, Apple has taken care of me every single time. And again, I don't think you'd get that kind of customer service from any other company. I've never experienced anything like it. So they've taken care of me. I really can't complain too much, even though it has been a little bit of a hassle. And we all have our stories, right? You've shared many of your stories with me. If you do have a story, good, bad, or otherwise, related to an experience with Apple, Apple support, and getting your computer repaired or fixed, I'm always happy to hear those. Sometimes we share them here on the show. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. Something we were talking about on the last episode of the MacCast was I had a listener, Daniel, who kind of felt like he was being left out by Apple's current Mac lineup. As I've mentioned, I think that Apple has one of the currently has one of the strongest Mac lineups that they've had in a really long time. But I did see Daniel's point that there are some areas of the market that are being maybe underserved, and he was particularly impacted by the low-cost version or end of the market, so a lower-priced Mac, specifically the $400, $500 Mac Mini, which had slowly risen to about $800 and really higher when you end up configuring it how you probably want it. So I was making the case that Apple really doesn't have anything serving the under $1,000 market at this point, and that the other hole in the market was the prosumer, the person looking for that $3,000 to $5,000 Pro Mac, something that the Mac Pro, the current generation, serves very well, but that the new Mac Pro, starting at about $6,000, really doesn't serve. So if you got that gap, right, you've got a $5,000 iMac Pro or a $6,000 Mac Pro, or on the other end, you have a MacBook Pro that is ranging somewhere from maybe $2,000 to $3,000, $3,500, depending upon how you configure it. I know you can get it a little bit higher, but really, you don't have that kind of mid-range. And something that showed up this week was a great article over on iMore. They ran a piece talking about how you can configure a Mac Mini to maybe be that prosumer Mac that you might be looking for. I know, you wouldn't think, right? I mentioned the idea of Apple maybe at some point doing a mini version of the new Pro Tower, like a mini Pro Tower. But the Mac Mini actually is not a slouch. Now, you're going to have to spend some money, and it seems a little bit crazy with a Mac Mini, but when you start to spec it out, and this was kind of the point of the iMore article, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, it does make some sense. Now, there is a couple big caveats to this. One is that you're not going to be getting enterprise-level components like ECC RAM or Xeon CPUs with a Mac Mini, but you can get some pretty good performance, and you might even be able to achieve some of the future upgradability with things like GPUs and storage using external enclosures and Thunderbolt. Yes, again, it's not the same as having a mini tower where all of that stuff is internal, but at least there is an option, and it started to make sense. So I wanted to talk about it a little bit, and we can have a discussion. You can agree or disagree, but I think spec-wise, it looks pretty good. And so here's how you put it together, or here's how iMore put it together. Start with a upper base model Mac Mini, which starts at just over $1,000, $1,099 US, and then upgrade the CPU to the 6-core, 12-thread i7 running at 3.2 gigahertz with a turbo boost up to 4.5 gigahertz. Now, that gets the CPU close to the 8-core, 16-thread, 3.5 gigahertz base Mac Pro. So what we're comparing here is sort of a proed out Mac Mini to the $6,000, $5,000, I think $6,000 base Mac Pro model. We're seeing how close can we get to that in terms of matching performance and components and stuff like that. So the processor gets close. There's a lot more caching on the Mac Pro. And again, you've got a Xeon versus a consumer grade processor. So there is that big difference there. But, you know, overall, CPU performance should be pretty good with a 6-core, 12-thread i7 at 3.2 gigahertz in the Mac Mini. You can then upgrade the RAM from 16 gigabytes to 32 gigabytes. That matches what's in the base model Mac Pro. Once again, it's not ECC, but in this case, the Mac Mini may have the edge in being a little bit faster when it comes to the RAM because it's not having to do the error correction. Both the Mac Pro RAM and the Mac Mini RAM run at the same clock speed, 2,666 megahertz. So presumably, the Mac Mini memory might be a little bit faster. The storage we don't have to mess with because both of the base models or both models come with a paltry 256 gigabyte SSD. Yeah, that is not enough storage, but we're going to leave that one on the table. You're going to have to buy more with both of them, which is going to bump the prices up. You can upgrade the Mini to have a 10 gigabit Ethernet port, not two like on the Mac Pro, but at least one 10 gigabit Ethernet port. So you have super fast Ethernet. And then we get to the GPU. Now, obviously, with the Mini, you're not going to be able to plunk in a big, massive, you know, dual slot covering GPU. But what you can do is you can get an external enclosure and run an eGPU over the over a Thunderbolt 3 port. The enclosure is going to set you back about $300, and then you can get an off-the-shelf AMD RX 580 processor, which will be pretty close to the 580X that is in the Mac Pro. And because your external enclosure is going to have a standard port on it, not something proprietary to Apple like the fancy MPX module, in the future when you want to upgrade, you'd be able to buy an off-the-shelf GPU card, you know, another graphics card, and just upgrade. So advantage to the Mac Mini configuration here. Yes, you've got to run an external enclosure, but it's a minor sacrifice. You can, with that AMD RX 580, drive two 4K displays, and then you still have the built-in HDMI display port on the Mini, so you can actually drive three large displays with your new Mini Pro. So all of this put together and configured, what's the price for that Mini? Well, it's $3,480 US, or about $2,500 less than a similarly spec'd bottom of the line new Mac Pro, and you still have an upgradable Mac platform in the Mini. So it hits that prosumer sweet spot, I would say. Again, the built-in graphics aren't going to be the same, but again, with the eGPU, that would be a pretty nice setup and offer a lot of performance in most studios at that price point. And I'd be curious to know if anybody has put together a system like this. If we can track someone down who's actually using a Mac Mini for prosumer level work, I think it's definitely doable. When you're looking at just the specs, like I said, it makes sense. Now the question becomes, does it work in practice? And I don't have any evidence of that, but I don't see any reason why it wouldn't. It seems almost crazy to spend $3,500 on a Mac Mini, but you have to remember what you're getting inside the box and with all the components. It's not about the size of the machine, it's about what you can do with that machine and the upgradability. So, I don't know. What do you think? I thought it was a pretty good article. Again, I'll have a link to the full article in the show notes at maccast.com. And shoot me your feedback, your emails, your audio comments. I'd love to know what you think about this. And then finally for today, we haven't done this in a while, but I'm going to do a little preaching to you about backup. This all started when this week I heard from Phil, who says, hey, I have a massive iTunes video collection and it's growing, about 4 terabytes worth of this stuff spread across 2 2-terabyte hard drives. And his question in his email to me was, these drives aren't in a system like a Drobo or a Synology, so I know there's no redundancy, and chances are that if they go south, I will be out of luck. Is there an app that can test the health of the drive to see what is what? So he's looking to see, hey, I want to know when these drives are going to fail so that maybe I can replace them before they do, so I don't have to deal with losing my data. And Phil, yeah, of course, there are tons of apps and utilities that you can use to analyze the health of your drive and to help work on those drives. You've got Apple's own disk utility. You've got apps like Drive Genius or Tech Tool Pro. If you run into, you know, bigger problems or have a problem with your drive, you might even be able to salvage it with a tool like Drive Warrior. They are all great, incredible applications. They do what they say they do, and I would recommend any of them to anybody if you want general utilities for maintaining and working on your hard drives. And, you know, Drive Genius and Tech Tool Pro can analyze other components and things on your Mac as well. So they're great utilities to have in your toolkit, but reality check, you know, even if you analyze the drive and it says, hey, this drive is totally healthy, a hard drive, it can fail at any moment. It can fail when it's brand new. It can fail when it's 10 years old. It can fail just for any reason, especially if it's a spinning drive. It's got moving parts and components. You don't know when those things might go south. If it gets bumped the wrong way, if it gets moved the wrong way, you could have problems. There's just no guarantees. It's a hard drive. We've all been through this. So even if you're running utilities on them and checking them frequently and stuff like that, it really still is no substitute for a good backup scheme. And relying on Apple to have the media for you, because some people will write in after hearing this and say, well, doesn't Apple have, I bought everything through iTunes. Don't they have all those movies on there and I can just re-download them out of my account whenever I want? So they have my backup. They actually don't. I can show you emails and things from people who have bought music on iTunes, have bought movies and TV shows on iTunes. Apple, just like any other company, they have to license that stuff. They have to do deals with record labels and movie companies. Sometimes some of that stuff goes away. So Apple always recommends that you back up your own purchased files. You download them. I do this on my main Mac at home. I download all the movies that I purchase, and I back them up to, in my case, a Drobo. I also back them up offline and also in an archive. So I have three backups of all of my iTunes media. I don't think you have to go that crazy, Phil, but absolutely, you should be backing up that data. And the point is that it's easy and it's relatively inexpensive. Compared to the, I don't know, thousands of dollars you probably spent acquiring all that media, you can, for less than $100 or $150 with the software, back it all up right now. If you go on to Amazon, and I just bought one of these for my growing iTunes library. I had a 2 terabyte external hard drive that I was using for my iTunes media. It got full, because I buy a lot of movies and stuff through iTunes as well, but I like to back them up. I needed another drive, so I bought a 4 terabyte Western Digital hard drive, USB 3 external. It's a portable drive, so it's bus-powered, really easy to use. It was under $100 on Amazon. I think I paid around $80 for 4 terabytes of storage. Simple, easy. Add a copy of Carbon Copy Cloner to that for about $40. And for 140, you know, well, 70 plus 40, what's that? $110. For $110, you can protect your entire investment of thousands of dollars worth of media. It is worth it. Believe me. Just do it. Don't wait. Do it now. Go buy something. Protect your investment, and it's going to do a way better job than just scanning the disks and trying to figure out when your hard drive is going to fail. And I'll say also, while you're at it, if you're not doing a cloud backup or an offsite backup, set that up as well. Backblaze is the service that I use. There are other ones out there. I happen to like Backblaze because I think their pricing is simple. They let you, for $6 a month or $5 a month if you sign up for a year up front, back up a Mac and all of its connected and network drives, unlimited storage for $60 a year. It is so worth it. I can't stress this to anyone out there enough. If you're not doing backup, stop what you're doing right now and get a backup scheme together. There is nothing worse than the email that I get that says, "Hey, Adam, I know you talk about backup all the time, but," and the "but" usually is, "how do I recover you know, these precious family memories and photos or media, this stuff that I lost because I didn't do a backup. And inevitably, my answer to them is you can spend several thousand dollars with a company like DriveSavers and hope that they recover your data. They're actually really good and they usually can recover the data. But again, it's going to cost you literally thousands of dollars, and you could avoid it all by paying less than $100 right now to put together a backup scheme. So there you go. I've preached. It's been a long time since I've done it. I kind of felt like we needed to do it again. There's my sermon, and that is going to be it. And with that, that will do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen for iOS, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on their great software by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You will find them at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. This is a community podcast. You are very much a part of it. If you have an email or if you have a question, a comment, an audio comment, and you want to send that to me, you can do that in a couple ways. You can call in on the listener hotline. That phone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave a voicemail there. You can send me an email to maccast@gmail.com, and I'll get your messages that way. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that will do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.